Unveiling the secrets A-list copywriters use to make themselves and their clients millions. This is the Copywriters Podcast with your host, the world's greatest copywriting coach, David Garfinkel.
Let's go back to the 1980s, before internet marketing had ever really begun. Our very special guest today and returning champion was working as a tech writer in the foreign exchange trading department of Bankers Trust in New York. In his new book, How the Web Won, the inside story of how a motley crew of outsiders hijacked the information superhighway and struck a blow for human freedom, Ken McCarthy writes, "Working with foreign exchange traders taught me an important lesson about the need for speed in business. Windows of opportunity open and close fast. That understanding, combined with my discovery of the rudiments of direct marketing, has been worth millions to me and a whole lot more to my clients." That's one of the many powerful lessons from Ken's new book, How the Web Won. He's been around internet marketing longer than anyone else I know, and possibly longer than anyone else, period. In 1994, he sponsored the first conference about the business potential of the World Wide Web, with keynote speaker Mark Andreessen, at the time, the 23-year-old co-founder of Netscape, an early internet browser and the first important one. Time magazine pointed out that Ken was the first person to identify the importance and business power of the click-through rate, which today, of course, is the basis of the roughly $500 billion a year Facebook and Google make selling pay-per-click advertising. In 2002, Ken started an event called the System Seminar, which I attended a few years later myself in San Francisco. I met Frank Kern, Gary Halbert, Harlan Kilstein, and a whole bunch of other people who were or became legends in direct marketing. It was as important an event for me as an earlier seminar I attended in Key West, Florida, that Gary Halbert put on. We could spend the rest of the show talking about all of Ken's accomplishments, but I'd rather tell you that he tell you about his new book, How the Web Was Won. So, Ken, welcome, and congrats on your new book.
Thanks, and thanks for having me.
Okay, Ken, so in 1993, you attended a conference called 1BBSCon. I'm not sure from your book if that was the moment that changed your life, since you'd been doing some pretty good pulling rabbits out of hats with direct marketing before then. But could you talk about if that was an inflection point and how what you learned at the conference influenced you going forward?
Oh, yeah, that was a huge turning point. That was the bridge for me, from offline to online. And previous to that, you know, all we had was paper and ink, audio cassettes if we were fancy, video cassettes if we were super fancy, Google AdWords. There was no Facebook ads. There were no sequential autoresponder. There were no squeeze pages. You know, there were no email lists. There were no banner ads. I could go on and on and on. What we had was the BBS world, and BBS is short for Computer Bulletin Board Service, right? And if you're of a certain age, you know what I'm talking about. If you're not, you're like, what are you talking about? The big ones were AOL, which I think everybody's heard of, CompuServe, Prodigy, and these were big corporate ventures, and they had hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of subscribers. Now, this is the key word. When you were on, and there were tens of thousands of small bulletin boards, local bulletin boards, and the keyword is subscribers, because you once you were on like the AOL service, that was it. You were on AOL. You weren't on Comp. You couldn't see what was going on CompuServe. You couldn't even send email to somebody on CompuServe or message them. So the model at that time was everyone would have their own digital island with a, I guess an island doesn't need a moat around it, but you know, your own digital island if you were the proprietor. And the idea was to get as many people onto your service as possible. And the internet blew that up. And the first step to that was having internet email. All the services realized, gee, we better give everybody an internet email address. So it became johnsmith@aol.com. Bill Jones at CompuServe.com, and suddenly everybody could send email back and forth. And email was then, and still is today, you know, just an incredibly powerful medium. The idea that you can send a message to somebody on the other side of the world in an instant is still quite powerful. So I went to this conference of BBS operators. They had, I'm trying to remember, they had like 120 different sessions, and I think five of them were devoted to the internet. Four of them were super technical, and only one of them discussed business. And the one, and this was, you know, they have to understand, this was the cutting edge of the online world at the time, literally. And the one that discussed business was so, I hate to say it, but was so lame. And the guys on the panel had no business experience, no marketing experience, no sales experience. And half of them said, nope, you can't do business on the internet. It'll never happen. And then the other half said, you could probably do it, but we don't know how. And the best idea circa summer of 1993 was, we'll do an arbitrage with fax machines. So you can send an email to China, and there'll be a fax machine in China that will send a fax locally to somebody, and it will save the fax charges. That was the best idea in 1993 for how to use the internet online to make money. And actually, you know, the internet was, it was prohibited from doing business on the internet from right up until 1989, because it was viewed as, you know, it was government funded. And it's like, hey, this is for our purposes, not for you to sell used cars or whatever it is you want to do. This is just for us. But then 1989, that switched, and they said, okay, do business. And nothing happened. Nothing happened in 1993.
Yeah, I want to get back to that whole 1989 thing and your first conference where, you know, you had Mark Andreessen. But there's another conference I'd like to talk about first, if you don't mind. And that is when you were invited to Dan Kennedy's conference in 1993. I can't imagine that a lot of the hardcore old school direct marketers who paid $5,000 a piece to be there were all that receptive at the time to what you had to say. Were they?
Well, I'm going to say two things about that. One, Dan deserves incredible recognition in 1993 to invite someone to talk about online matters. He always gets tagged as being a guy that knows nothing about technology and he's behind the times, and it's, you know, he's not behind anybody's times. You know, he's just very particular on how he does things. So that was part one. Part two is, I really prepared for that presentation. I knew what the audience was. I knew the audience was not on there. They weren't online. Some of them weren't even barely using personal computers. So I knew I had to make this presentation make sense. So yes, they were receptive, partially because they were just good guys, but also because I really tailored the presentation specifically to their interests. And my pitch was, hey, this thing seems to be happening. And the good thing about it is we can send mail to people without having to pay for the postage and printing. And therefore, it behooves you to get an email address and to start experimenting with putting your email address, because there were no websites. Put your email address in ads and see if any of your prospects and customers choose to communicate with you that way. Because if they do, you will build a very valuable asset of email leads that you can follow up on for free. So that was good advice in 93. I think it's still good advice in 2025.
Yeah, that's interesting. Wow, 100 hours for a one-hour presentation, but I think you made the right choice. I mean, Dan's particular, so are his people. They're pretty demanding, you know, in terms of the practical, applicable value of what you're saying.
You know, a part of this, my book, How the Web Won, is meant to be instructional by example. And if we've got one lesson there, is there are presentations that are so important that it's worth putting 100 hours to prepare for a one-hour presentation. And I didn't know it at the time. I should have. I guess I did intuitively, that Dan was, you know, checking me out. And if I had gone in there and winged it with some BS, that would have been the last time I would have ever communicated with Dan Kennedy. Sure. Instead, I had a, you know, pretty much bulletproof, solid gold presentation. And from that day on until he sold the company to Bill Glazer, which I think was 2002, I was the only guy he let speak about online issues in his conferences, which was literally worth millions of dollars to me. I mean, just not figuratively, absolutely, literally.
That's great. Let's get back to the government. And, you know, I remember in the early days of the internet, you know, early 90s, you know, not only were there regulations against it, there was a whole academic, philosophical, kind of left-leaning anti-business group on the internet that said, no, we cannot pollute our pure internet environment with dirty commerce and that. How fast did that change in the 90s? What were the key moments for that? And how did your San Francisco conference fit into all of that?
Gotcha. Yes, you're absolutely right in your perception. Number one, nothing happened when the government declared you could do business on the internet in 89, in 90, 91, 92, 93, until 94, because everybody that was doing stuff with the internet and even knew what the internet was and how to do anything on it was a software engineer. And most of them were students or relatively recent graduates, right? So they were engineers, not business people, not marketers, and they probably were left-leaning.
And another thing besides that is, you know, if you weren't alive then, you wouldn't know that the entrepreneurial revolution and the idea of 16-year-old or 18-year-old building 7- and 8-figure companies, that wasn't the thing then, like it is now. Like, what if everyone thinks the way it is now about entrepreneurship has been true for all time? No, it was different then.
Absolutely. And there were kind of two phases, and you probably remember there was a time when it was hard to find a book on direct mail or direct marketing. They were out there.
Oh, yeah.
But it wasn't right.
I was furious because of that. I mean, I kind of based my whole career on the fact that I couldn't find that stuff.
Yeah. So all the stuff that we take for granted, you know, somebody coming up with an idea and buying traffic and starting a business, like that barely existed at all. Everything was very corporate and buttoned up. So that was wave one. And then wave two, of course, was the internet when finally, you know, people that had some technical knowledge, didn't matter their age, could do something online and on business. So, but there, in addition to the fact that everybody who was using the internet as a, you know, as a knowledgeable person was a technician, the pioneers of being on the internet were very left-leaning, and they were very anti-business, anti-commerce, anti-capitalism, you know, all those things you see around today. That stuff didn't happen yesterday. That's been around forever. So the biggest breakthrough, there were two big breakthroughs, and one of them I talk about in the book. Actually, I think both I talk about in the book. One is the banner ad, because then as now, it's kind of hard to sell physical products with low margins on the internet profitably. I mean, there are certainly millions of people that have figured out how to do it. But if you recall, Amazon didn't show a profit, I think, until, I don't know, something like 5, 7, 8 years. It was a long time before they started to show profits.
Yeah, I remember.
And so, yeah, so the real money in internet commerce, in quotes, was selling advertising, was, you know, putting up content and making eyeballs available to advertisers, right? And the pivot point there was the banner ad. There, believe it or not, there was only one company really that was selling link. There was a company that sold links. They were called Global Net Navigator. And their whole business was, because the internet, the web, this, now we're into the web era. The web was so small. Well, to set this so everybody understands, when 1993 dawned, for all practical purposes, no civilian had ever heard of the World Wide Web. It was not on anybody's radar unless you were, you know, an online, you know, guy, right? In 1995, August, it became like a cause célèbre, right? It was like the most important thing in the world after the IPO of Netscape. But in 93, it was primitive. So one company, this was their business, Global Net Navigator. You'd go to their web page, and they would point you out. They would point web pages to you, like, "Hey, here's one on dogs. Here's one on plumbing. Wow, here's one on skiing in Colorado." You know, it's like completely random. And the attraction was not the content, was that the fact that there was a website, about a website at all, and that this website actually had semi-useful, interesting stuff on it. So that was Global Net Navigator. And they sold links. And the link they sold was to the homepage. So you buy a link, people would click on your homepage, and you go to the homepage. There'd be no ads. There'd be no sales letters. There'd be no opt-in boxes. It was just, hey, publicity for my little website. So the banner ad was when things started to get serious. So that the banner ad has this following pedigree. So I did a conference, small one, in May of 94, and I had Mr. Internet, Mark Graham, came. I brought Mark Fleischman, who was the world's first full-time independent webmaster and web designer, the first one on Earth, who made a living from it, or attempted to make a living from it. And then the other guy I brought was a guy named Rick Boyce. And Rick Boyce was a media buyer for Hal Reiney and Partners. Okay, and a media buyer basically buys ads, right? Just like a, you know, same thing that they do today, except there was no online, right? So I thought Rick, I had met Rick at another conference, not related to the internet. I thought he was super bright. I said, Rick, I think you should come. He's a young guy, you know, my age at the time. We were the same age, 35, 34. I think he was younger than me. I said, come to this little meeting we're having. I'm going to bring Mr. Internet. I'm going to bring a guy that's a full-time professional web developer. Maybe we could all put our heads together and figure out how to commercialize the internet. Because as of May of 1994, nobody had figured it out. They were talking about it. They were writing about it. But no money was changing hands and nothing was happening. So we had this little meeting and lasted a day, and we really didn't come up with any good ideas. But at the very last minute, as we were all breaking up, I had this idea, and I brought Mr. Internet over, Mark Graham, and I brought Rick over, and I said, Mark, tell me if this is accurate. This is how ignorant I was. We can put a little square on a web page. People can click on that square, and it can take them to a whole other website, and we can count how many people saw the page and how many people clicked on that. And I turned to Mark, and I said, is that technically possible? Right? Sounds ludicrous now. And he said, oh, yeah, we can absolutely do that. And I said, Rick, I think this is the way we're going to advertise on the internet. So then I had a meeting with Rick about a month later in his office in Hal Reiney and Partners. And he had the standard rate and data service encyclopedia, not just the direct mail and mail order one, but for radio. There was one for TV. There's one for billboards. And there was one for miscellaneous. So he said, I don't know how we're going to work this thing, Ken, but here's a book that it would fit in. We could list these opportunities in the miscellaneous standard rate and data service, okay? A few months later, not many, Wired Magazine, which was hugely influential at the time, started their own online magazine called Hotwired. And this was the first time that a real business and real publishers put a flag in the ground and said, we're going to hire people to create content and we're going to sell ads to keep the lights on. That was the first time in history. And Rick Boyce was the man that sold the banner ad. So it was very successful. That launch was very successful because Wired already had a whole stable of advertisers. And the pitch was, hey, give us $10,000. We'll put one of these little squares on one of our segments, you know, one of our divisions on Hotwired, and you can sponsor it for a month. And you know how big advertisers are. $10,000 is a rounding error.
Right.
And they all wanted to be cool, so they all flipped $10,000 checks to Rick. So the CPM for those ads was between $400 and $700 CPM. Now, people thought that was sustainable, right?
Right.
And lots of people looked at that huge success and started their own websites that were going to run with advertising, right? And Rick was the first to calculate the click-through rate and report that back to his customers. And, of course, click-through rates on the very first issue of Hotwired, click-through rates were like 50%,
wow.
Right? Because there was a shortage, a scarcity, a famine, whatever you want to call it, of things to click on. There just weren't that many things to click on. So people would just click on anything, right? So
yeah.
The first click-through rate was 50 and over. And the first CPM was, you know, five. By the way, I don't know what CPMs are now, but they're usually a dollar or less. cost per thousand views. Right? So that's the birth of advertising on the internet. And that actually was the birth of the commercial internet, because it was the publishers that were making money and were actually encouraging other people to jump in. That created the content, because it was a chicken and egg. Do I go through all the hassle of getting a modem? Can't even remember what it's called.
Yeah.
I got to get a modem. I got to do that. I got to get a special account. I got to download the browser. It was a pain in the ass. So you would only do that if there was good content, but there was no motivation to put up good content, because how are you going to make money? So it's chicken and egg. So as the content grew, the users grew. As the users grew, the content grew. And then we came finally to August 1995. And there were now enough people using the web that when the IPO for Netscape, the original browser company, hit, there was like this huge market of people ready to, hey, I'll buy 10 shares, I'll buy 100 shares, I'll buy 1,000 shares, depending on, and that's why we have a commercial internet. And we almost didn't have a commercial internet. And I could talk about that if you'd find that interesting.
Well, I'd be more interested in knowing when internet marketing as we know it today really started to get traction. Can you pinpoint a time or a time period when that happened?
Yeah, there were gunslingers right out of the gate. You know, there were really sharp people in 94, you know, who were using email. One of my favorite guys from those early days is Jonathan Mizell, Cyberwave Media. He had the very first print newsletter for us, you know, not for corporate. There were a few corporate ones, but he was the first person that had a print newsletter for entrepreneurs on online marketing. There was the great Corey Rudel. Who unfortunately,
Corey Rudel,
died at a very young age in a car accident. He was a genius. He was so far ahead of everybody. So you had touches of people here and there, but really, I don't think the internet marketing became a thing until after the .com crash, because the whole thing, it was very, very hard to persuade anybody to use direct marketing principles on the internet before the .com crash. As you might have had experience with too, you know.
I did. You know, I was just learning direct marketing. I had a previous career in journalism, and then I pretty much started direct marketing in the early 90s. And I said, this is the kind of advertising I can actually get behind and believe in, and that was cool. And then I saw what people were doing on the internet, and it was really nuts. In fact, I was editor of a print paid subscription newsletter called What's Working Online before the .com. And it was kind of unfocused, and I wasn't really in charge of it. They dropped me in there so that they could sell the whole company. It was one of those plays. And I just basically had to grind stuff out. But what I found is like the top 25 companies, so-called companies rated by, I don't remember who, in the year 2000, only one left is Amazon, I think. All the other ones weren't left. And I was stunned by the rationale. I mean, you remember the famous clip from 60 Minutes where some very certain idiot is saying, if you don't have a website, if you don't have all your business on a website, you'll be out of business. And right. Crazy, you know, insane, you know, diluted stuff like that. But what I'd like to hear from you, because I did have somewhat of a focus on that, but I think you saw the bigger picture over the longer time span. What would you say was the biggest mistake made by the companies that went bankrupt during the .com of 2000? And how long did it take the direct marketing way of thinking to catch on?
Gotcha. Well, I mean, literally, and I was very close to it, in the late 90s, if you could fog a mirror, you could get $10 million to start an internet business. Okay. And if you personally were having trouble finding advertising that made sense online, it was no reflection on you. It wasn't happening. These companies literally thought, we'll put up a website and then we'll declare victory. And then the main advertising vehicle in those days for companies that were funded were TV spots, believe it or not. because there weren't many places to advertise. There were banner ads, and a lot of companies did spend a lot of money on.
They'd use a TV commercial to get people to go to their website.
Oh yeah, because they had. I mean, the problem then, and it's kind of the problem happening now in AI, is like you give these guys. Well, then it was millions. Now it seems to be billions, and they've got to go out and spend it. And they may not have had any previous experience in sales, marketing, or running a business at all. They just were able. Their main qualification is they could put up a flashy website. So we had hundreds and hundreds of those, maybe thousands of those businesses floating around.
One thing I've noticed. I mean, let's fast forward, jump to 2025. One thing I've noticed with some very large companies I'm working with right now is even though they don't totally get the principles of direct marketing, some do, some don't, because of the ability to track from the click through a heat map to the sale, they're starting to focus more on performance and statistics, right? I still wouldn't say that the internet is as direct marketing a medium as I think it should be. Of course, I'm biased because I see everything through that lens. But I guess, and I do remember, when was it? It seems like it was in the last 10 years, the amount of spending for online advertising eclipsed the amount of spending for offline advertising. But what I'm curious is, to the degree that we can say people understand direct marketing online, and of course it's usually much more entrepreneurs than it is large corporations, when would you say that started to become? Because okay, I won't even finish the question. You know, we've often been called like the black sheep, or the redheaded stepchild of advertising. Right? Direct marketers. I mean, we were just never taken seriously. And now they kind of don't have any choice. But when would you say that really started to sink in as a legitimate, viable, mainstream way of thinking?
Okay, well, after everything crashed and burned to the ground, the survivors said, what do we do now? And things were so dire in the middle of that crash that you know, ad tech, which is I don't know if it still exists, but it was a huge company. It was until relatively recently. They almost went out of business because nobody was talking about ads on the internet anymore, right? My friend Ed Niehaus, who had 140 employees, a PR firm that specialized in internet.
I knew Ed, yeah.
Yeah, we were friends. So that, you know, we realized that company just vaporized. Like they had a floor in Manhattan, they had a floor in San Mateo, and next thing you knew, they were gone, you know? So it was like a neutron bomb that hit the whole industry. It was down. So, and I'm going to answer your question because the answer is me. When everybody else had pulled their seminars and conferences and how to make money on the internet and how to start, you know, then we had 9/11, which didn't help. And I said, well, you know what? I've been trying to sell this internet as a direct marketing medium for 7 years. Everybody else is disappeared. I'm going to come and try again. Because I spent the whole 90s. I wasted a lot of time in the 1990s. So the thing that gave us a boost, and I have to say it was the system seminar. I don't know who else. I mean, Corey for sure. Corey was still alive and Corey was doing amazing stuff and teaching a lot of people. But in terms of the model that we have now, which would include A-B split testing, I mean, I didn't invent A-B split testing. But I taught people who were on the internet to use A-B split testing. You know, so that was one thing. Long form copy. I didn't invent long form copy, but I taught people explicitly, use it. Yes, it will work. Yes, people will read and read and read and read some more if they're interested. We also were the first to teach large numbers of people. Now, again, there were always like a few smart guys that were doing this stuff, but nobody was teaching it, right? So we were the first people to teach the idea of a squeeze page. The idea that, look, if somebody gets to your page, you better do everything you can to grab them. We didn't call it a squeeze page, but we said, you can't just say, join my mailing list. That's not going to, that worked in 1993. That's not going to work in 2002. So we taught that. And then we taught how to use a sequential autoresponder. That was a technology that I personally started working on in 95. I failed miserably, But luckily, what's the one that I use? AWeber did not fail. And in 97, they started their business. I think we also had GetResponse and so on. So then you had that other piece. So there were a lot of pieces of the puzzle. We needed to be able to buy clicks, focused clicks. So that we had to wait until Overture, first they were GoTo, then they were Overture, right? And then the big thing though was Google coming out with AdWords. So finally we could buy clicks. We could, when we drove people to a page, we had a plan for how to monetize them. We knew that we were going to have to follow up, and we knew that there was a technology, and we knew how to use it. We knew that we didn't know what we were doing, so we better test various options. So we used the old A-B split testing. All those things were taught in 2002 by the only guy that was teaching internet marketing in 2002. I don't think you'll find any other live events that were traveling around teaching internet marketing, because everybody had given up. One, the market had crashed, so all the buzz. I mean, a lot of people thought this internet thing's over. Like, this is it. That was fun. Now we're on to the next thing. And then, you had 9/11, which if people weren't around then, that was very disruptive, very traumatic. I was regularly on airplanes, full, you know, jetliners, commercial, where there'd be me and five other guys, because people weren't flying. We were able to get hotel conference space for nothing. I mean, we drove hard bargains. But anyway, if people want to know when did this model of digital advertising begin, Corey Rudel, Jonathan Mizell, a handful of other people. But in terms of systematizing it and teaching it to people in large numbers, that really was the system seminar. And that's what I was doing in 2002 until I retired from that in 2011.
Let's talk about the book as a whole, although I think we have been. what else would you like to tell people about it? Because there's so much in it. It's so good.
That's a big piece right there. I'd like to tell people that it was not inevitable. This is the most important thing, at least from my point of view, that it wasn't inevitable. So we had this BBS world, we had the CompuServes, we had, you know, the AOLs, and the model, the business model was get subscribers to come to your service, addict them to the extent that you can, and make money, you know, that was from their subscription fees. Lurking in the background was a little company in Bellevue. I think they called it, is it Bellevue, Washington? Washington, called Microsoft, with a very mild-mannered, non-aggressive man named Bill Gates. And he had not yet entered the online arena. He had plans to. AOL sort of stole a march on them. They went from 100,000 subscribers to 1 million subscribers in 1993. At which point AOL said, oh, we better gear up our Microsoft MSN. That's when everybody knows about MSNBC. People don't realize MSNBC was originally a partnership between Microsoft and NBC. They had some vague idea that television was going to be interactive and Microsoft was going to provide the software and NBC was going to provide the news and all that. So they fully intended to create their own online service in competition with AOL, CompuServe, blah, 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 blah. Now, young folk don't know that Bill Gates owned the computer industry in the 1990s.
He did.
Lock, stock, and barrel, because 95% of all, Apple was on its way out of business. 95% of all computers were PCs, and Gates controlled the operating system, which sounds like a boring word, but call it the desktop. He owned the desktop. Like right now, it's like I can go on there, I can look at any one of 10 trillion web pages. I can put all kinds of stuff on my desktop. In the early 1990s, the only things that appeared on your desktop were what Bill Gates permitted to appear on your desktop.
Yep.
If you know that, I know that, older guys know that, young people, just let that sink in for a second. All right. What would have happened if in 1993, Bill Gates had gotten his shit together and gotten Microsoft Network working and put the Join Microsoft Network button on the startup page of Microsoft. You know, so when you powered up your computer, you would have been invited to join the Microsoft network. First thing he would have done was put CompuServe and AOL out of business, right? Second thing he would have done, and he was very good at this, is he would have persuaded the computer news media, which he controlled. I mean, I know people, because you know Ed Niehaus, and I knew Ed Niehaus, and he was a top PR guy. He said, my business is simple. I keep small companies, I keep, you know, startups alive long enough for Bill Gates to either buy them and or destroy them. That's the business.
Did you know Philippe Kahn?
I know his name.
I interviewed him once. I don't know if he told me or someone else told me. Apparently, Bill Gates came to a party at Philippe's house. Philippe pushed him into the pool, and Microsoft subsequently destroyed Sidekick, his company. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Bill Gates. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, they had the power to destroy companies, and one of their leverages of power was the computer press, but also the mainstream news media, but specifically the computer press. Because they bought half the ads. So it was not uncommon, if you were an editor at CompuWorld or one of these things, to have Steve Ballmer personally call you up and chew your ass out for saying something slightly sideways about Microsoft. So this is the level of power they had. So not only had they had Microsoft Network up and running, not only could they have put it on their desktop, the desktop they controlled, and driven Microsoft and, AOL and all the rest of them out of business, they could have possibly badgered the computer press and by extension, the mainstream press into not giving the web any attention. If the web hadn't gotten attention, the world would have woken up and 90% of people's experience of the online world would have been through the Microsoft network.
Well,
and we
got to wrap up, but I'd like to say thank you, Bill Gates, for failing to seize that opportunity. Every entrepreneur fails to seize a lot of opportunities. No disrespect, Matt. He's done quite well, but that was the choice he made.
They just couldn't get it together fast enough. And so the bottom line, and I know you've got a time limit, and so do I. The bottom line is, people made the web. All right, we had the Netscape. Had Wall Street pour in, all that stuff happened. But the people that laid the platform for it were people like me and people like Jonathan Mizell and people like Mark Graham and Mark Fleischman and Corey Rudel and thousands and thousands of people whose names you've never heard of built the foundation for it. And it was not a guarantee that we were going to get this beautiful media. You know, it has a lot of problems, obviously. But it is a beautiful medium, and it's beautiful for this reason. Yes. That wants to publish something and make it available to the whole world can do it without going through a gatekeeper. That is a beautiful, beautiful thing. Anyone that wants to start a business, if they can figure out how to get a web page up, they're on their way, you know? And that did not exist before we came along and before the web won.
Well, let's talk about people who can get your book on Amazon. You have a website about the book, howthewebwon.com, right?
Yep. Yep.
And people want to get in touch with you. How would they do that?
Best way to do that is I have a circa 2008 website, kenmccarthy.com. And if you hunt around, because I want motivated people, I don't want random people contacting me, you'll find my contact information there. And if you have a business reason to be in touch with me, I'd love to hear from you. You know, I still advise. I had a great luck with Tom. Oh, what's his name? How can I? Anyway. This guy gave me $4,000 for 2 hours of my time, and he said it added $600,000 instantly to a promotion that he was doing. And I figured, okay, that's a good ROI, and that's what I'm always aiming for. You know, so if you need high octane, I'm available, but you gotta make a little effort to find me. KenMccarthy.com, pretty easy.
Sounds good.
All right. Wow, a lot of information in today's episode. If you want to check out the show notes, find all of the links that we just talked about, they will be on the website over at copywriterspodcast.com. I am hopeful for the future. I'm one of the people that the internet was a great equalizer for me and gave me a bunch of opportunity, and I think that that's just going to keep going. So hopefully the future is similar with the history, and if you want to check that out, howthewebwaswon.com as well. Until next time, we will catch you later.
Catch you later, and thanks, Ken.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. This was fun.
Hey, if you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app so we can get into ears of more listeners. Thank you.